You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, my name is TK Kapurai and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of The Global Cell, which airs live in the air room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out their lived experiences so the world can know something about them. I like to bring a lot through my guests so we may have diverse experiences, cultures, foods, music, interests, and anything on the platform. We can share and learn a lot through their live instructions. Let's do this together, not only for a better platform for our community, but a better community for our platform. Again, tune in for my show, The Global Cell, live in the air room, the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also available on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO's end of year campaign is happening right now. We invite you to donate and become a member today. We have the full spectrum of ways to join. Go to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. You can also mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Cut through the clouds and make it rain to help us meet our $75,000 goal by December 31st.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Welcome to Out of the Streets of Portland, a podcast focused on sharing the stories of people who are currently or formerly homeless in our community and helping people navigate the systems and services that the Joint Office of Homeless Services and its partners either have in place or are developing to help people move out of homelessness and back into stable, supportive housing. Today, we'll be sharing two stories of people who struggled for years living on the streets of Portland and are both now in more stable situations. The Joint Office of Homeless Services funds over 100 local service providers. Between them, they provide every type of support, from helping people navigate from living in a car or camp into stable supportive housing, to connecting people suffering with mental health or substance use disorders into treatment centers that can help them recover. More information on the many providers we support can be found on our website, johs.us. On today's podcast, we share the stories of two people. First up is Nettie, a Street Roots vendor who sells papers in the Woodstock neighborhood. She's also part of the Street Roots mobile journalism team, funded and supported by the Joint Office of Homeless Services.
I grew up in an all-black neighborhood. All black women had their homes. There was parents and fathers were available. Mothers was making ends meet. And somewhere about 1973, they had a bright idea to bus the black children out to the white North Seattle. And I ended up on a yellow bus going out there for the sixth grade. And in the seventh grade, a girl had some marijuana out there. I had never even seen marijuana. And she was going to school, she was black. And she kept saying, come on, smoke, smoke. And then next thing you know, I was trying to take a hit, but I didn't inhale it. And then the second time when I did inhale it, I was instantly addicted. And then from there, it went from one little joint, they call them doobies, to heroin addiction and crack and cocaine addiction before crack ever came. I never had street intelligence. I just was a strong cold drug addict, and I just lived from drug to drug. I wanted to stay drugged out because my reality was too much for me. They say, you know, I'm starting to work a new 12-step program since the pandemic is on Zoom, so we can go to England, Russia, Africa for Zoom meetings and meet other recovering addicts. in Narcotics Anonymous, they call it the 12 steps. They call it a disease, right? When I look back on it, my dad, he was a excellent metal worker, but he drank the wine and died from alcoholism, but it was wine. It was serious, Tokay wine. And my mother gambled, and she worried, raising 11 kids by herself. But and she didn't use nothing. And what I think personally is everybody has that predisposition, and once you exposed to it. I had a troubled youth. I was always in and out of trouble. I had to always read the back page of the book before I ever opened up the front page. I couldn't concentrate. Looking at a book was like The Three Bears. Was my favorite book. It's the only book I ever read until I read Roots in 1999 or something like that, when I found out blacks were slaves. I didn't even know blacks were slaves until 1999. We were getting the educations at Stevens Elementary in the CD, right? But what happened is I was not able to contain any type of information. They wasn't talking about that for sure, right? In 74 or whatever, they wasn't talking about it, but there was Black Panthers in our neighborhood that taught a lot of the kids. And when they found out that I didn't know about slavery, they said, come on, Omari them taught us well. He's a Black civil rights leader in Seattle, Omari Tahee. And I said, nah. And my sister said, don't tell nobody else you don't know that, right? And why would I hold it back? I thought they were fighting over the toilets, Martin Luther King. I thought they was fighting over the water and the garbage, and also the Woolworths counter. Those are things I vaguely remember. I never knew black people was out in the field getting beat down and raped and killed and all that. Oh my God. And then I was in jail in Redding, California, on drugs, left Portland to go to try to get away from here. And I got pulled over in Redding for stealing. And I was in that jail, and a white guard, I forgot her name, but she had blonde hair. She told this black girl from Redding was in there. She was a frequent flyer, like I used to be in Seattle for the Redding jail. So she said to the lady, if you didn't like us here, you shouldn't have brought us here. And I said, she didn't bring me here. I came down I-5. And her name was Queenie. She said, but they brought your ancestors. And I said, they did? And she said, you didn't know that? I said, no. She said, don't let nobody else in here know you don't know that. We was only 3 blacks in the whole jail. And that's when they sentenced me back to prison, when they transferred me back to Clark County, Washington, and I read Roots. I always loved Dr. King and Coretta Scott King, because when Dr. King died, I remember my mother would not stop crying. That's all I remember. So I knew something happened, but I thought he was fighting over Woolworth's counter or the garbage man, something to that effect. I think he died in 68. I was 8. We didn't have, we never was hungry. We never was homeless. Everybody came to our house and eat, so I thought we was doing just fine, right? But realistically, when you have 10 kids, 11 kids, and one of them is disabled, and maybe a few more was disabled, and there was no resources available to help mama with counseling for us. First time I went to a dentist, I was 12, and that was after my daddy ended up on SSI disability. We ended up getting disability with mama. I had rotten teeth everywhere. So no, it wasn't my mother's struggle. It was the reality of the blacks in the 60s and before that. And then my older brothers and them had to work and help with school clothes. Mama didn't have time to come up there for no PTA stuff, but I guarantee you one thing she didn't do is leave us alone. And there wasn't one night in my whole life, as long as I wasn't on drugs, that I didn't know where my mother was. So no, I'm not gonna say that my mother was struggling. What I'm saying is that there was no opportunities at all. And at one point in prison, they tried to convince me it was my mother's fault, until I learned history. Till I put 2 and 2 together, and I look at me, and I look at you, and I look at other mothers with their daughters, and I look at jobs, and I look at how they treat black people at the jobs. Don't put a homeless tombstone over everybody down there on the streets. Some people is rich, some people is poor, some people got mental, some people got depression, some people got rape issues, trauma issues, and some people just want to fit in. There's many reasons why we use drugs, but once we use it, And it takes away that pain. It takes a whole lot to get us well. They're not there. They need help. They're doing the best they can. But I don't let them get that close to me because I don't want to ever start to think about dope that with another addict, because they'll get me high before I get them clean. So I got to have a strict boundary. But I know, looking what I'm seeing. I know what I'm seeing. I know what's happening with, can we get the people to the hospital? A hospital that somebody can really help them, and everybody's not going to make it. It's a war. Everybody's not going to make it, but you could get some of them before it's too late.
That was Nettie from the Street Roots mobile journalism team. Next up, we hear from Ryan, who is stabilized from years of struggling with mental health and substance use issues. He's now a resident and board member of Hazelnut Grove, one of the more than 20 villages of tiny homes that have grown up in recent years to provide stability for people coming out of homelessness. Most of these villages receive support from the Joint Office of Homeless Services.
There was a lot of arguing going on at home, and I thought I could do better on my own. And I, my proud butt, you know, walked out the door like, oh yeah, I can do. And it was a series of runaway reports and being brought back home, and then, you know, arriving at the same problem, and then me leaving, and then being brought by the, you know, it was a cycle for a couple of years where I was on a merry-go-round kind of, and then I turned 18 and I was an adult, and I was free to roam. But by that point, I had already discovered addiction. You know, I had already discovered meth. And in that course of that 2 years, I had conquered meth. It was 1998 or 99. I was in a tent with somebody. We were getting high, and I just realized that it was like, I don't like the way this drug makes me feel. I don't like what I do when I'm on this drug. I'm watching myself destroy my life. Like, I'm getting into the sex industry. You know, and that happens a lot for a lot of homeless people. There's a lot of human trafficking going on in Portland, and a lot of really beautiful, really intelligent girls, women, young women get kind of kidnapped, and they get sucked into that life where they're trapped. They can't get out. But that's neither here nor there. There's a really dark underbelly to Portland. Portland has a really dark side, and I try to stay in the light. One night I was watching myself do things that I didn't agree with, and I said, okay, I'm done. And I haven't touched it since. That was over 20 years ago. I had to. I was watching, I was like, oh, I could watch my life be turned over into just something, a shadow of what Mom had wanted for me, you know? And I don't think it was good to if I'm gonna live right by her, I gotta honor me too. And then I got on and off of meth early on, and then I discovered hallucinogens, and I became part of the Rainbow Family, and I started traveling all over the country, and I was doing the hippie circuit, kind of, you know, the Grateful Dead family kind of show, hitting the concert lots, the lot life, you know, that, and I discovered that wasn't what I wanted either. And I got into activism really hardcore on and off when I would wake up and realize I needed a job and I needed to get my life in order. You know, I tried to get a job and to get an apartment, and I'd usually get a job with Democracy Resources, Democratic Resources Now, DNR. Or
is that like a agency that?
Yeah, they were a political agency, and then I worked for the Sierra Club for a while. In 2013, I started hearing voices and seeing things that were not reality. You know, that it's like other people were. I could tell. You know, it was not reality. It was like, this is a hallucination. What the heck is going on here? I need to get. I was like, I don't know what to do, and so I turned myself into a mental hospital. I turned myself into a psych ward. I was like, I'm hearing voices, I'm seeing things, while they were counseling me, I went over every sin I could think of in my entire life, and I just let it all out. So I had this moment of truth where I was just letting everything out. It was like, I did this, I did that, I did this. Well, oh, and when I was six, I did this. You know, and they were like, wow, you were really honest. So I said, yeah, well, you know, truth is worth it. I came to grips with the fact that I am not the perfect son that I thought I was, you know. I definitely have come to understand there are some aspects of myself that I want to work on. You know, there are some parts of myself that I want to improve. There are some parts of myself that I wanted to delete, you know, or try to trauma process them through shadow work, you know, to where I can fully integrate that aspect of myself back into my being and be whole, you know. I'm really going for wholeness is what I'm going for these days. I started hearing the voices on the winter, the Thanksgiving 2013, and I turned myself into the mental hospital, and then I got out of the mental hospital, couldn't go back to the apartment that I was staying in with my stepdad, because my stepdad was creeped out by the fact that I was in the mental hospital. So I was on the streets again. I went to City Team. You know City Team?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I went to City Team, and I got on their short-term program, and I got a job at ESP, Electro Eastside Plating, they're an electro plating facility, I saved money. I was staying at their shelter, saved money, you know, quit smoking cigarettes, quit smoking pot, quit. I quit doing everything. I was clean and clean and straight, 100%. And then I came home from work one day. It was at work one day, and the voices started acting up, and they basically possessed me to beat my face in with a palm sander at work. And a coworker saw it and reported to the boss, and the boss fired me. They had to let me go because I was a danger, you know, I was a danger to the work environment. I sailed around the community for a while, from couch to couch. I was couch hopping for a while there. I'm sleeping down the drum circle spot. I don't know if you know Veercats Esplanade. I was sleeping down there. And then, I was tired. I was like, I'm tired of being on the streets again, because I had gone out to Wyoming, and I had gotten a job at a motel, and they let me trade for a room, and I was having my room, but I was trying to chase down my ex, and it was just not a good situation, and I got out of there. Sheila Graham, who owned Graham's Groceries in Riverton, Wyoming, she bought me a bus ticket home to Portland. She was like, "You need to be home with your family for Christmas. God told me, you need to go home." And so I accepted the bus ticket and got home. And I got into another shelter. I got into the Bud Clark down over there on Hawthorne. And I was trying to do day labor to save up money for another place. And I couldn't get enough work. And they timed me out the day after Thanksgiving. And they kicked me out the day after Thanksgiving. I had nowhere to go. And then I remembered Joe Benny. Joe Benny and Jose Serica were like, "Hey, we have a new camp. You should come check it out." And I was like, "New camp? That's the new home." And that happened to be what is now Hazelmont Grove. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the tent city back then. It was a huge tent city.
Yeah.
And I have watched that piece of land turn from a Wild West kill or be killed type of law system, and where it was every man for himself, and I watched it turn into a thriving community with people who live by community standards. Well, a group of people try to live by community standards. There are a few rabble rousers. That land and villages, hopefully, I intend to go on encouraging growth of villages like it. I want to see more of that village model thrive. I'm gonna be working towards that goal. But I think giving people the opportunity to build something for themselves is, in a way, more of a hand up than a hand out. Because you go to the shelters, they give you the bed, they give you the meal, they give you the shower, but in the morning you're gone. In the morning it's back out into the cold world. Like at Hazelmont Grove, I wake up in the morning and I have my morning cigarette and I look out my front door and I go, "Okay, well, what are we gonna do today? What's today gonna be?" You know, and minus cigarette, of course. But having that moment in the morning where you're in your space, and you go, "Okay, this is me. Like, how can I improve from here? Where can I go from here?" You know, giving people that opportunity, I think, it's the highest value. It really is the highest value.
Because you're building community.
Yeah. Well, we're building governance is what we're doing. I mean, because the governance is the commonwealth. You know, it's like the way I see it is like you have the body of people being governed, right? You have the body of the people. But they're like the way it's supposed to work is that the system rules by consent of the governed. So really, the commonwealth is the will of the people. And I know for my little end of the commonwealth, I want to see me thrive. You know, and I imagine everybody else wants to see themselves do well too. So if the common well-being is the real commonwealth, then I think we have a vested interest in creating a governing system that is conducive to that commonwealth. The Grove sent several people to Overlook neighborhood meetings and the ice cream socials, and you know, we were like, "Hey, look, we're just trying to make it. We're just don't have as much money. You know, we're all the same. We're all just trying to make it." You know, that's what I would challenge average Joe citizen to do whilst driving down the freeway, looking at the tents, looking at tent after tent after tent along the side of the road is to realize that's you. You know, that's Joe. That's Joe Citizen. They're just in the cracks.
That was Ryan, a resident and board member of Hazelnut Grove, a tiny home community of formerly homeless households located on Greeley Avenue, just off Interstate in Portland. This podcast is produced by the Joint Office of Homeless Services, a Multnomah County department with funding from the county, the city of Portland, Metro, and the state and federal governments to house, shelter, and provide street outreach, navigation, employment assistance, assistance obtaining Social Security income, and case management to people experiencing homelessness in our community. Please subscribe to our podcast to get notified every time a new episode is posted. Look out for our next episode in January 2024, which will focus on the PATH team, Providing Access to Hope, at Multnomah County. The PATH team helps those who are houseless or about to lose housing get treatment for a substance use disorder. As always, you can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by searching for Out of the Streets of Portland. And you can find this podcast, along with a ton of information, data, and reports, at our website, johs.us. Thanks again for listening to Out of the Streets of Portland.
next, special programming about the current LPFM window. Just this past Wednesday and until next Wednesday, December 13th, the window for filing applications for new low-power FM stations is open.
I am resilient, I trust the movement. I negate the chaos, uplift the negative. I'll show up at the table again and again.
I'm Carolyn Harding, and today I'm talking with Sharon M. Scott, co-founder and general manager of the low-power community radio station ART FM, WXOX 97.1 FM in Louisville, Kentucky.